This is Focus Perth with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
People across the globe spend between $30 and $40 billion chasing a good night's sleep. They're buying sleep trackers, comfortable mattresses, cuddle blankets, apps and podcasts that tell stories and play sleepy music.
Hey, you up all night tossing, turning, mind racing, trouble getting to sleep, trouble staying asleep? Well, welcome. This is Sleep With Me, the podcast that puts you to sleep. We do as a bedtime story.
Fatigue costs Australia a staggering $66.3 billion in lost productivity each year. So it's no wonder this business is booming. So today on Focus, we are going deep into the science of sleep. And in the studio with me is Professor Peter Eastwood. He's from the Centre for Sleep Science at UWA, and he is also president of the Australasian Sleep Association. Welcome.
Good morning, Nadia.
And he is here to take your calls. If you do have a question, 1300 222 720, or you can text on 0437 922 720. And Professor, the most basic question, what constitutes a good night's sleep?
I guess we can judge it ourselves and ask the question, do we feel adequately rested the following day? And that's a pretty good guide to whether you've had a good night's sleep. The reasons for not feeling adequately rested are numerous, and it may be, you know, inadequate sleep duration. It may be not sleeping particularly well because of a sleep disorder. But I think the best guide is to ask yourself, you know, how do I feel? Do I feel rested after that night's sleep? That'll give you an idea of whether you've had enough.
So it's not necessarily 8 hours.
No, there's actually a wide variation in what individual sleep need is. Most guidelines suggest we require between 7 and 9 hours sleep, and that's an adult. And, you know, there's variation around that. But we do know that people who sleep for less than 5.5 hours, which is about 15 to 20% of the population, they tend to have the majority of them feel very sleepy the following day. Those that sleep between 7 and 9 hours tend to feel more rested. So we know that information. And that's adult, and it varies significantly in children who require a lot more sleep than the 7 to 9 hours.
So what about, say, teenagers and also children?
Well, children, young you know, preschoolers, young children require up to 11 hours sleep, and teenagers require anywhere from 9 to 10 hours sleep. The challenge with teenagers, of course, is that their body clocks change and they want to stay up late. They've got these kind of school requirements to get up in the morning, so they unfortunately don't get their 9 to 10 hours very frequently, and they are kind of chronically sleep deprived, like the rest of us.
And then we add a mobile phone to that equation, and we will get onto that in a moment. Is it also about the quality of sleep? Is that often in a lot of cases more important than the amount of hours you're sleeping?
Look, I think it's a combination of both, Nadia. You need to have the quality of sleep and you need to have the quantity of sleep. Quality of sleep is much harder to assess than quantity. We roughly know how many hours sleep we're in bed for and how many hours of sleep we are asleep for. What we don't know so well is what we're doing when we're asleep. If we have a sleep disorder, it's rare that you know you're a snorer yourself. It's rare that you know you have sleep apnea. It's rare that you know you kick your legs during sleep. And quite often it's the partner that refers their partner into the sleep clinic for investigation or to their GP, saying, I can't sleep with you anymore, you're too noisy, you kick me, all those kinds of things. So we're very poor at perceiving our own sleep quality.
So really, unless somebody tells us, we don't know.
Yep, the best guide you have is how you feel the next day.
Yeah.
You know, if you feel like you are unrefreshed, unrested, then you can suspect either not enough sleep in terms of length or poor quality sleep.
And that's the hint. I mean, that is the sign. If you are getting that consistently, feeling that way, then is that the simplest sign that something is wrong?
I think that is the simplest sign that something is wrong. We all should feel adequately rested after sleep. That's what sleep is for, to recover our kind of brain functions, our cognitive functions, and to recover our physical functions. So we should feel kind of mentally aware, we should feel mentally ready for the day, and we should feel physically rested when we wake up.
There's a lot of commentary these days about sleep and the quality of sleep, and it's a massive, massive industry now. Is it a more significant health issue now than it was 30 or 40 years ago? Are we actually sleeping less, or is that a myth?
We are sleeping less, and it's understandable because we live in this electronic age where we have access to social media 24/7. We've got news running 24/7, and 100 years ago we didn't have the light bulb, so now we've got lights 24/7. 100 years ago we would go to sleep when it was dark, we'd wake up when it was light, and so we operate in this very different world. Our body clocks have not changed. Our body clock wants us to go to sleep when it's dark and awake when it's light. Yet we're doing the opposite to that, and our bodies fight against that, which is why we really do live in a sleep-deprived society at the moment.
Professor Peter Eastwood is my guest on Focus this morning, and he's here to take your calls. We are talking about sleep, and Professor Peter Eastwood is with the Centre for Sleep Science at UWA. 1300 222 720 if you have a question. You can also text a question through on 0437 922 720. You touched there on this digital age and the mobile phones and electronic devices that are keeping us up. Is that, what are the other main reasons we don't sleep? Is that the biggest issue, that the distraction of that device?
Yeah, look, I think there's two reasons we don't sleep so well. One could be actual sleep disorders, which we don't know about ourselves, but our partners might. And the other are the external influences that you're just talking about, Nadia, like social media, like television, like Facebook, you know, getting on these screens late at night. And if they're not kind of pushing your sleep back, they're putting you in a stage, a body in a state where you're not ready for sleep. I mean, what we need to do in fall asleep is to kind of relax our bodies. And if we're watching, you know, kind of movies, active movies, or we're playing video games, our body's kind of getting ramped up at a time when it actually wants to kind of slow down and get itself ready for sleep. So preparation for sleep is very important. In fact, the light coming out of quite a few of these devices is a trigger for your brain to say, stay awake. You know, light is the strongest trigger for our body clock, and the light's coming from screens, from tablets, from phones. They're telling our clock that you should be awake, and that's another problem.
So when should we turn all that off?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's two ways to think about electronic devices. One is kind of a passive use and one's an active use. Active use may be something like video games. Passive use may be something like watching TV or just reading your Kindle. And the guidelines suggest that an hour and a half of using one of these devices with light coming out of it is sufficient to start decreasing your melatonin levels in your body. And melatonin is really important to signal to your body that you want to fall asleep. So an hour and a half before you go to sleep, I think it's important to avoid using these things if you can. And if you have to use them, and a lot of people do, then switch from the active use to a passive use. So play video games earlier in the evening and do something a bit quieter, like read a book on your Kindle or watch telly perhaps later on. But ideally, if it's causing you to delay your sleep, then you've got to think about just giving yourself a longer period prior to falling asleep.
The economics of this are quite interesting as well, because something like $66 billion is lost in productivity, and that's attributed to fatigue. That sounds very significant.
Yeah, the economics are staggering. And you know, we've been talking to a lot of federal parliamentarians about this, and they're very concerned about the economic cost of sleep in Australia. And we're trying to encourage them to even consider having a parliamentary or a government inquiry on this issue. It's recognised as a problem by the independents, by Liberal, by Labor. So there's this bipartisan issue which people are acknowledging and recognising. The cost scares the politicians, of course. The health consequences scares those of us who work in the area. And of that $66 billion, you know, $40 billion can be related to poor kind of health, and $26 billion to direct health consequences of sleep disorders and lost productivity.
So what would an inquiry need to look at?
Yeah, it'd look across the board. It would ask the question, do we have sufficient awareness of sleep and the importance of sleep in Australia? In my view, we should be thinking about the three pillars of health, one being a healthy diet, one being healthy exercise. We all know about those two. The third should be healthy sleep. The economic argument is there. The health argument is there. So I think we need to have a public awareness campaign, a bit like the norm, healthy exercise campaign from years ago. Because if we can educate people on the importance of sleep, then we can make some really substantial differences in, you know, kind of national health and also the national budget.
We talk about fatigue, the obvious side effect of a lack of sleep, but what about other health impacts? I read studies and it talks about night owls, for instance, have a 10% high mortality rate. There is an increased risk of health problems like diabetes and heart disease, and also mental health issues that are associated with sleep.
Yeah, it's interesting, Nadia, because it's only been the last maybe 20 years that we've had really good data and studies done on the effects of sleep and poor sleep. And we now know that inadequate sleep and sleep disorders affects pretty much every organ of the body. So there's an increased risk. If you have a sleep disorder, sleep apnea, say, you have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, increased risk of diabetes. It affects mental function, increased risk of mental disorders, a dementia. You know, it's all interrelated. And all the signals say we just need to start taking this a bit more seriously.
Professor Peter Eastwood is here from the Centre for Sleep Science at UWA, and he's here to take your calls, 1300 222 720. Let's go to Roslyn. Good morning, Roslyn.
Oh, good morning. I noticed when you were reading off the things that cause problems with sleep, you didn't mention grinding your teeth.
You're a teeth grinder, are you, Roslyn?
I am a teeth grinder, yes. My dentist told me that.
Hi, Roslyn. You're not alone. It's very common. And I'm glad that your dentist has identified that. And we call teeth grinding bruxism. And bruxism is a sleep disorder. It occurs when you're asleep. And, you know, if you've ever heard someone with teeth grinding, it is definitely loud. And I can never believe how much noise the teeth can make. So it's an issue. It's a dental issue. It's caused by kind of muscles in the throat kind of turning on at a time when they shouldn't, and you grinding. And it's related to, you know, anxiety can be a part of it. Sleep apnea can be a part of it. So it's one of those things. I think you're on the right track by talking to your dentist, and they have techniques to deal with that, like a mouth guard, for example. But if you still have problems, then I think
I take the mouth guard out during the night, you know, in my sleep, because it annoys me.
Oh, that's a problem, because your bruxism will come back then.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I just thought, as you hadn't mentioned that, I probably should, because a lot of people may not know that they have it. I don't have a partner, so there's no one there hearing me, but my sister did tell me that I used to do it when I was a child as well.
Rosalind, thank you for that. Good luck. Just on that note too, June says, if you are single with no partner to tell you you have disruptive sleep, then is there any way you can judge for yourself? I'm 60 years old and I never feel I get a deep sleep.
Look, I think that the guideline is, how do you feel the following morning? Honestly, if you wake up feeling a million bucks, like you look at 10-year-old boys and girls, they wake up and they're a million miles an hour because they've usually had good night's sleep. And there's no reason at all that adults who have adequate sleep shouldn't feel the same. Now, if you're not, then have a think about what might be going on. There is a fantastic website. It's called the Sleep Health Foundation. It's a website which is for the community. It's all the fact sheets in there talk about things like bruxism and poor sleep and snoring and sleep apnea, and they're all written by medical professionals. So, you know, I'd encourage, you know, all of your listeners, Nadia, to go to the Sleep Health Foundation website for more information. That's a great place to start. If after you've been there you've still got questions, then it's worthwhile talking to your GP, who may or may not refer you to a sleep specialist.
And I think it was the Sleep Health Foundation that today released a report looking at teenagers and sleep. And they say screen time, caffeine and stress is keeping teenagers awake at night. They're only getting 6.5 to 7 hours, as opposed to that 10 to 12 that you talked about.
Yeah, and it's also related to behavioural performance. It's related to academic performance. So it's in our best interest as parents to try and help our teenagers get as much sleep as they can, for both their, you know, behavioural good and also their kind of academic good. So they're a hard group to deal with, because, as I say, their body clocks are pushed back a bit and they tend to go to sleep later. But if we can encourage them to get as much sleep as they can, avoid that extra hour of TV watching and use that to get sleep, then, you know, over a long term, that can make a substantial beneficial effect.
1300 222 720, if you have a question for Professor Peter Eastwood to do with your sleep and your sleeping patterns. And there's a couple of other things that we're going to get to, our medicinal cannabis, in a moment, because I know you've got some trials going on underway. But I just want to go to Cliff first, who's been patiently waiting. Hi, Cliff.
Yes, good morning, Nadia. Good morning, Peter. Look, trying to get the brain to go into absolute neutral when you're going to sleep is probably the hardest thing. I've had problems all my life. I'm 62 years old. I'm using CPAP therapy, but that's another matter altogether. But there's a recognised syndrome, I believe, called stuck song syndrome, otherwise known as earworm. And it's one of these things when you go down, as soon as you put your head on the pillow, all you can have is just this ridiculous song that you might not even like. It just goes over and over and over in the head. And then every time I wake up, if I have managed to get up to sleep, then off it goes again, and I just can't sort of release that that sound that is just annoying me to death. So that's the thing that's interrupting with my sleep patterns, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem you've got there, and there is a new field of sleep medicine, relatively new, which is sleep psychology, and these are, you know, psychologists who specialise in sleep disorders. And what they're very good at doing is helping people with insomnia, for example, who, you know, can't turn off their brains and keep waking up and can't go back to sleep, or can't fall asleep initially because their brains are going a million miles an hour. They're very good at giving you strategies to deal with that. So I'd actually suggest you have a chat to your GP and see if you can get a referral to a psychologist who specialises in sleep. You may find that really does help.
Best of luck with that, Cliff, and thank you for contacting us. AJ on the text wants to know if there are any links between sleep deprivation and dementia or Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. There's some really good studies out of the US and Europe showing that long-term inadequate sleep, whether due to just poor sleep habits or to the presence of sleep disorders, is related to a number of these problems, mental health issues, dementia, Alzheimer's. So the answer there is absolutely yes. The data is getting stronger and stronger and stronger by the minute. So again, it's a consequence of long-term sleep issues. And that's why I think we need to just be more aware of what we're doing now. It's interesting, you know, there's an interesting link with schizophrenia, and schizophrenia is a mental health disorder that's characterised by intermittent episodes. And there's more and more data coming out showing that, you know, prior to an episode, if you look at someone's sleep, their sleep patterns are changing. So it may be that poor sleep leads you, or kind of makes you more susceptible to having an episode if you have schizophrenia, for example. So an appreciation of the effects of sleep on mental health is very, very important.
On Twitter, Pete wants to know, he says his little brother moans in his sleep and it can be heard through the whole house. He said it's definitely not a snore but a moan. Is there a cause for concern there?
Probably not. I mean, children are making all kinds of weird and wonderful things during their sleep, including nightmares. They're quite common in children. Moaning, sleep talking, sleep walking, all those things, they're quite common and quite normal for children, and they tend to grow out of them by their, you know, 10, 11, 12. No, I think just keep an eye on it, and in time it will probably get better.
Sarah says we need exercise, fresh air, less caffeine and alcohol, no blue light and a hug. And this text as well, our two little boys get 12 to 13 hours sleep every night and they're still little brats. Do they need more sleep?
Absolutely
no,
<not. laughs>
that's just the way they are. Four Corners last night touched on the use of some trials in regard to using medicinal cannabis to treat insomnia. This is something you're involved with. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, look, we've been approached by a company, a Perth-based company called Zelda, and they're a very innovative company, and they are interested in alternative treatments for diseases based on the use of medicinal cannabis, which has been legalised in Australia for the past 2 years. And the University of Western Australia, the Centre for Sleep Science, we've been asked to help them develop a trial to see if medicinal cannabis will make an effect, will help insomnia. And it's you know, we're scientists, so we've worked with them to design a trial which is what we would call a double-blind placebo crossover trial. So the patients don't know whether they're getting the drug or not. The researchers don't know whether they're giving the patient the drug or not, and we're analysing the data independently. So,
and why doing it that way? Does that that means there's no sort of bias or preconceived idea of what may happen or expectation?
Exactly, Nadia. It's you know, we as humans are very good at thinking something works if we want it to work. And that's why a placebo is very important. So if you're not quite sure which is the active and which is the kind of non-active or placebo condition, then, you know, we as humans kind of can't can't fake the system at all. And that's one of the basic premises of any drug testing or device testing in Australia, is that you test it without the people knowing whether it's working or not. So you get an objective, evidence-based assessment of how it works. And that's what we're doing with this this insomnia trial. Medicinal cannabis is this particular one. We've got other trials going on with mouthguard devices and devices implanted under the chin to treat sleep apnea. So there's lots of research going on at the moment to try and treat sleep disorders. And you know, University of Western Australia, we're lucky because we have a very good research program and we get asked to be involved in these international trials.
Now, we did a panel a couple of weeks ago on medicinal cannabis, so we're all aware that marijuana and medicinal cannabis are different because of the different chemicals that are removed or extracted. But some people might be listening going, well, we all know that if you smoke a joint, you get tired. Is it that simple a translation into medicinal cannabis?
Well, it's not quite that simple. I mean, there have been lots of trials in the US about medicinal cannabis looking at things like pain and nausea with people who are on chemotherapy, and they've had very good results with that. One of the side effects is that these people tend to get quite drowsy. So that's why there's a bit of a hint that there may be an effect of medicinal cannabis on insomnia. And the beauty about the medicinal nature of it is that you can adjust the concentrations of all these drugs within it. So that's the important thing, is that you have no control over what you buy in the street in terms of what it is, but you have absolute control and well-regulated in the medicinal cannabis world. So that's the direction they're heading.
And what's the thinking behind it? Is this a short-term fix? Would there be addiction issues, or would this be something you would have to continually be on to ensure a good night's sleep?
At this stage, no one's quite sure, to be honest, Nadia. I'd say the current treatment for insomnia are sleeping pills, things like benzodiazepines. The problem with them is that they have nasty side effects and they're quite addictive. So I think if you can find alternative treatments that are less addictive, or perhaps non-addictive, perhaps more natural, perhaps as effective, then it's certainly worth looking at, because insomnia is such a huge problem in society. We need to try and get that sorted out.
And medicinal cannabis wouldn't be addictive? Or is that part of your trial? That's part of your research?
No, it's not necessarily part of this trial, but there's no evidence that it would be addictive at this stage in other trials. But, you know, it's very early days in this industry.
Let's take another call. Matt joins us. Good morning, Matt.
Morning. I've got a different take on the old counting sheep. Because I'm a technical person, I'm always thinking of solutions, and sometimes you find it hard to go to sleep. I visualise a whiteboard with writing on it and then cleaning the whiteboard down, but I never get to the end because I fall asleep before I finish it.
And that's just a visualisation technique? That's all you do?
Yeah, and it works quite well for me.
All right, let's get a response from the professor. Thank you very much for that. One example of a visualisation technique. Do these things work?
Absolutely. I think if you can find something that works for you, then good on you. And again, there'll be no one recipe that works for everyone, so I'm really happy that works for you. And I think we've all tried different things when we've had lots of things running around our mind, and sometimes you just can't do it. And I think the solution then is to actually get out of bed. And get out of bed, go and sit somewhere quiet for a while, don't turn the telly on, do something in the dark room, go back to bed, and you know, try and teach your brain that bed's for sleep. But again, if these are long-term problems, if you can't solve them yourself, I think you do need to go and see a health professional.
And some great tips coming through here, 1300 222 720, and just on that, because we see there are so many sleep aids now. How do you know, as you said, okay, we know about prescription medication, there are addictive issues with that and there are side effects, so we know about that. But we are now seeing personal data trackers and sleep trackers. There's certain things you can hug, and spooning robots and all these things. I mean, how do we know what works and what doesn't?
Yeah, I mean, as a scientist, I kind of move towards the evidence-based devices, the evidence-based medicine. And you know, I think about one of the great success stories in biotech out of Australia is a company called ResMed. And they invented CPAP, which is continuous positive airways pressure, which is the gold standard treatment for sleep apnea. And they are one of the three big biotech successes in Australia's history. And they've done lots of clinical trials, and they've shown, based on good scientific evidence, it works, it makes a huge effect, a positive effect. So that's an example of a device that's clinically proven to work. In terms of sleep trackers, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you think about companies like Jawbone and Fitbit, they are billion-dollar companies.
Yeah.
And they claim to measure sleep. We don't know how well they do that because their algorithms are black boxes. We do know from some side-by-side comparisons that, you know, while they're quite good at measuring sleep, they're not particularly good at measuring brief wake periods during sleep. And it's the brief wake periods during sleep that cause you to have fragmented sleep and poor sleep quality. So while these consumer-based devices, I think, are really useful for letting us know roughly what our sleep-wake patterns are, they can't tell you anything necessarily about your sleep architecture, so the pattern of sleep, the depth of sleep, or about the quality of sleep.
And that's what you need to know.
That's what we need to know. I think any knowledge about any increased knowledge among society about sleep and your own sleep duration is important. It's good. But I think you shouldn't kind of overestimate the capacity of these really consumer-based devices to help you diagnose sleep or sleep disorders, which they cannot do.
Okay, we're running out of time. I'm going to try and squeeze some more questions in. A couple of quick ones on the text. Ginny wants to know if the use of melatonin supplements will assist getting to sleep.
Yes, in some cases. Melatonin is a pretty good, it's a natural drug. It's the drug that we produce naturally before we fall asleep. And about an hour before we fall asleep, our melatonin levels start rising. So it's a particularly useful perhaps with jet lag. When you go travel over east and your body clock's been moved out by 3 hours, perhaps you can trick your body into thinking it should be going to sleep by taking melatonin 1 hour before you want to go to sleep. And that's generally how it's used. Some people swear by it. I've tried it. It doesn't work for me. So again, you know, there's no one rule for everyone, but it's a safe drug. There are guidelines on how to use it. Again, the Sleep Health Foundation has a good fact sheet on that. And, you know, it's worth having a go. And if it works for you, then you know, I think it's good.
And John wants to know, he's 70. He sleeps for 9 to 10 hours a night and he wishes he could sleep less. Is that a normal night's sleep for a 70-year-old?
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, this is the range we have. I mean, there is no one set time at which we as humans sleep. And it's also it's interesting this, Nadia, there's no evidence that you can genetically change your predisposition for sleep. So if I'm genetically wired to require 9 hours sleep, there is no evidence that I can reduce that in any way.
So don't try.
I mean, so I think you work out strategies to deal with less sleep. And the strategy is that we kind of function when our body's perhaps less rested. But unfortunately, what you got's what you got, and there's no evidence that you can change that.
Michael has contacted us. Now, Michael, you're using a sleep apnea machine, but you still don't sleep well.
Yes, it was working for a number of years. I actually gave up drinking 12 months ago, and I'd have a few beers each night, go to bed, and I didn't notice it. But now I'm finding that probably around 3-4 o'clock in the morning, I'm waking up and the throat is really dry and I've had a sore throat ongoing. I took the machine in and they adjusted it and said, we've adjusted the level, it should be okay, you know, with the humidifier part of it. But it still didn't work. I've got a chin strap that I wear and all I'm doing now is just wearing the chin strap and not using the machine. My throat isn't as sore. It's cleared up. But I still feel like I'm not really getting enough sleep.
Yeah, look, thanks, Michael. It's interesting your comments about waking up with a sore throat. It's probably due to one of two things. One is that you're sleeping and breathing through your mouth, which means that you're not humidifying your air through your nose and you wake up with a dry throat because your throat dries out. Alternatively, you may still be having these periods where the airway collapses and vibrates, and that can actually just make the airway irritated. So for someone like yourself who's been on treatment for sleep apnea and has had the pressures bumped up a bit, I think what you need to do is actually go to a sleep physician and go and spend a night in the sleep lab where they can monitor and see exactly what's going on. The treatments you're talking about are these mouth guards, and there's some well-trained dentists out there who can fit these mouth guards and they understand sleep. We're putting an accreditation process together at the Australasian Sleep Association to try and help help the public understand which are the trained dentists out there. There are a few in Western Australia, very good ones. But it's a therapy that doesn't work in everyone. So you need to work in a partnership with the sleep physician and the sleep dentist to work out if that's going to work for you. So, Michael, I'd suggest you go back and talk to your sleep physician again and raise these issues you just raised with us, with them, and see which way you should go forward.
Well, good luck with that, Michael, and thank you for giving us a call. We are running out of time. Professor Peter Eastwood, we'll have to get you back in again. There is a couple of calls and texts we will not have time to get to today. But Sleep Health Foundation, that is certainly a good start for people, isn't it, to get some good advice on that website?
It's a fantastic start. I mean, and it's even a good place to go, the Australasian Sleep Association website for health professionals like GPs. There's not much training on sleep disorders, even in the undergraduate medical curriculum anywhere in Australia. So everyone's on this learning curve right now, including the health professionals. So Sleep Health Foundation, Australasian Sleep Association, that's where you'll get the best evidence-based information about sleep disorders and their treatments.
We'll keep an eye on your trials and very keen to get you back in on the program again in the next few months.
Thanks very much, Nadia.
Good to have you here. That was Professor Peter Eastwood, Centre for Sleep Science at UWA. And I want to end this segment with a couple of more stories. Some of the silly things that people have done when they've been sleep deprived.
I went to the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games last week and I wanted a memento to remember the experience. I was pretty tired. You do long days. And I figured that this would just be a uniquely Gold Coast experience, getting a regrettable tattoo. So that's what I did. It's Borobie, the little surfing koala, the mascot of the 2018 Gold Coast Commonwealth Games. Yeah, but I was definitely fatigued at the time. And maybe better judgment might have prevailed had I not been so, you know, tired and stressed, emotional. But that's what's happened. So,
and what does your mum think, as Nadia asked?
Mum's okay with it.
I was tired, but I thought, well, this is the only opportunity that we're going to have to catch up. I haven't seen this friend of mine for like 20 years, and he was down in Dawesville. So I got in my car and drove down. Like, I knew I was tired and I couldn't keep my eyes open. It wasn't like a head nod falling asleep. It was that I needed sticks to keep my eyes open. But I also knew that if I pulled over, we weren't going to see each other. There were just times when I could feel my eyes just closing, but I kept going. And once or twice, I sort of found myself straddling two lanes on the road.
For a few moments, I'll be speaking quietly with you, and there'll be some quiet music, and you might enjoy listening for a while to what I'm saying before drifting off to sleep. Or you might just prefer to let my voice wash over you, letting the sounds carry you into deeply refreshing sleep.
I've got a really bad habit of waking up in the middle of the night, swimming up through drowsiness, convinced that there is a spider in my bed and that I need to get it out immediately. So in my fatigued state, I throw off all of the sheets and the doona and sprint out of bed full of adrenaline, only to realise that, in fact, there is no spider.
Oh, getting tired yet? Tricia says, on the text, I noticed while singing my 3-year-old grandson to sleep, I was also putting myself to sleep. Now if I have trouble falling asleep, I sing to myself and I'm out like a light.
Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth and on the ABC Listen app.